Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is technical journalist, Dr. Gina Smith. Gina, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I couldn't wait to have you on the show. You are such an interesting person. You are a New York Times bestseller, author of Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak's biography called iWoz, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Doing It. We'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. You're a former correspondent for ABC News, Good Morning America, Nightline, World News Tonight in 2020. You also hosted a nationally syndicated talk radio show with Leo Laporte. For more than a decade.
For a long time.
And recently you earned a PhD in clinical psychology. Wow.
I know. I wonder what I'm going to do with that.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
You have a similar background to me. You started off in chemistry. I started off in astrophysics. And as often happens, people who get into a technical background with science or engineering fall into computers, and then there is a magic moment, and then they get more involved in computers, and it can launch an entire career. So tell me about your early days with your degree in chemistry and what you were thinking at the time.
Well, you know, I majored in chemistry like a lot of people do in college. If they want to go to med school, you have to major in a science topic. And I majored in chemistry. And back in the day, late 80s, when I was in college in Florida, if you were a woman in Florida and you had a decent grade point average, they automatically accepted you in the medical school. So I was doing my first semester in medical school when I realized, boy, this was a mistake. I should write about science, not faint.
I've had some guests who were in law school and went all the way through law school and got to the point where they said, you know, I don't like this. I don't like the people. I don't like what I'm doing.
It's true. You know, I like the idea of being a doctor, but I was fainting at everything, and not just blood. I mean, like, here's an ear and I'm on the ground. Here's an eyeball. And I thought, whoa, who knew this about me?
Were your professors supportive in general, though?
Yeah, they were supportive in general. But the whole time I was in college and that 1 year of medical school, I was also writing, you know, and I worked for a number of little newspapers in Florida, and I was blowing off class to go to press conferences, you know, so it was pretty obvious I was, you know, doing the wrong thing. And so I course corrected and I worked for Knight Ritter, the Miami Herald group of newspapers that was around back then covering cops.
Heard of them. Everybody pronounces that name wrong, too.
Oh, how do they pronounce it?
I think a lot of people make the mistake of saying Knight Rider.
Like the show.
Yeah, but that's wrong. That's wrong.
Well, maybe. Yeah, well, that's funny. I was there at Knight Rider and just covering crime, you know, literally, you know, firebombings and burglaries and all that stuff. And I was just doing crime. And then one day, the guy that covered business and was sick, and IBM down in Boca Raton had a big announcement, and they sent me, and I loved it. I didn't have any trouble translating the, you know, the terminology into English, and, you know, they had trouble finding anybody to cover IBM back then for that exact reason, and I became kind of their business writer covering this stuff. But it wasn't until Sam Whitmore at PC Week got a hold of my resume that I really started tech journalism, and I started covering Microsoft and IBM's joint project OS2 in 1989.
I've used that once. Yeah. It's a
really
kind of weird OS.
I still have a Microsoft OS2 coffee cup. So there you go. Most people don't know about that. And so, yeah, and then I was just covering tech. But back then, there were very few tech reporters. No women, really, and just very few. I mean, even if you picked up the Wall Street Journal or something back then, it was very rare to see a technology piece, even though Microsoft was already a public company. You know, so those were the very early days.
Wow. So yeah, did you feel at the time that this was sort of a future possibility of a career for you, or were you just kind of going with the flow at the time?
Well, I mean, for any writer that goes from a daily newspaper to a trade, the first thing you notice is, wow, the pay is better, right? So I was psyched to go
the halcyon days.
Yeah, you go from the Miami Herald to I was, what, 23 years old, to PC Week, and suddenly I was actually making real money. It was, so I figured I'd be doing that kind of trade journalism for a while, but it wasn't for several years until I realized, oh, wait, I got in early on something really good.
Yeah, I remember when PC Week, the magazine, was it PC Magazine or PC Week, that was came out twice a month and was like 600 pages every edition? Was that the one?
Well, this was all Ziff Davis, and PC Magazine was the glossy magazine that was on the newsstand. Yeah. PC Week was a weekly.
And it was tabloid?
It was a tabloid size, but it was really targeting just IT people.
Oh, now I remember. Because there was a Mac Week, too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That was also Ziff Davis. We also had Mac Week.
That was an inspiration for me. Don Crabb was a writer who inspired me when I was in Oak Ridge at the National Laboratory reading Mac Week every week.
Wow, you were in Oak Ridge?
Yeah.
I should be interviewing you. That's cool.
That's where I was running a whole bunch of computers and got my strong education in Unix. And National Laboratory is a great place to work.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a great story.
So unfortunately, Don Crabb is no longer with us, but he was a great mobile warrior. He was always writing about his travels and his equipment and his notebook computers back in the early days when they were like thousands and thousands of dollars for a little 9-inch portable notebook computer that had an LCD screen. Wow.
Oh, they were so expensive. You couldn't get anywhere near a portable laptop in, let's say, 1991 for less than $6,000-$7,000.
My first notebook was a little Apple PowerBook 100 made by Sony, actually. I think it was about $2,000 was all I could afford at the time.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it all happened. You know, my first newspaper job, we used to have these acoustic couplers, and we'd plug into our system.
Nobody knows what that is. It's this device that has two cups on it, and when you had your old handset of the old days, you'd take the handset and you'd push it down in these two cups for transmit and receive.
How we used to file stories. So if I wrote a story on my computer and I wanted to send it to my newsroom, I could even go to a payphone, but you fit those cups over your receiver, and then it would send the file that way.
And then we got our little box with a 56K modem, and we thought we were living on the edge of the future.
It's really true. You know, I remember when AOL first came out, and, you know, boy, I wish I had kept that Gina@AOL.com. At the time, you know, because you're now, it's now very kind of trendy for some people to show that they've had been online that long.
Well, it's a stigma for some people too, you know, AOL address, you go, you know.
Yeah. Well, it is a stigma, but it's just, if people send you that and they're like, oh, I'm John at AOL, you go, whoa, you know, somebody, they've been around for a while. Yeah. It's kind of like a kitschy collectible. It's not something you really tell anyone.
How did you end up at the San Francisco Chronicle then? Was that next?
Yeah, that was next. So I was at PC Week and I was covering Microsoft. So back in those days, gosh, Bill Gates used to come to our newsroom in Boston once a month. And in these very early days of tech. And then Ziff Davis moved a magazine I worked at, which wasn't PC Week. It was PC Computing Magazine. They moved all 60 of us to San Francisco. And John Dvorak, I bet you've heard of him. He's, he's a mentor of mine since I was in my early 20s. And he contacted me and said, hey, the reporter that writes the Inside Silicon Valley column on the back page of the Examiner and Chronicle on Sundays is about to leave. You ought to apply for it. And I called Will Hurst at home. Instead of hanging up on me, he actually hired me. And I wrote that little column for a long, long time.
So this is a fascinating story because I've had so many guests who've said I was in the right place at the right time. I was persistent. I had some minimal skills in the early days that nobody else had because I was passionate and people jumped all over my skills, and then that developed into something bigger and better. That is a repeating theme from many, many of my guests.
Yeah, I bet you it's almost always true, right? It's just being able to be persistent. I thought that television reporters should cover computers. And I thought I could see that, you know, tech was going to get pretty big and most people had no clue how to get an email address. And I sent so many letters and tapes to ABC and, gosh, CBS, NBC for 3 or 4 years before I finally got lucky and somebody saw it. So I was the very first tech reporter on television.
Tell me about how you got involved. Well, okay, so ABC ended up hiring you eventually then, right? Is that what happened?
So I was always trying. I was doing these little free computer spots at KGO in San Francisco pre-dawn, and then using those tapes and sending them around, and nothing happened. And then one day, I think it was after we did a remote radio show, Leo and I, we were talking all about how Microsoft was misleading everybody about Windows 95. A producer walked up to me and said, "Hey, we're looking for someone to debate Bill Gates on McNeil Lehrer, and no one will do it."
Oh, that's
will
a memory. I remember that now. Yeah, Robert McNeil, he was great.
Yeah, I was like, sure, I'll debate Bill Gates on McNeil Lehrer. I mean, they were saying that any computer could run Windows 95, and the truth was, you may remember, you needed 16 megabytes of memory. No one had 16 megabytes of memory back then. And so I did this McNeil Lehrer live and, you know, flew to New York to do it. And then I flew back to San Francisco. When I walked in, my phone was ringing and I picked it up and it was a talent scout from ABC. It's like, "Hi, I'm a talent scout. We want to see if you want to come on Good Morning America." And I thought it was a joke. I'm like, "Come on. Who is this really?" She's like, "No, really."
And, so was it a one-time thing? Were they just offering to fly you out and do this one spot?
They offered for me to do 5 spots and see how they did. And I did those 5 spots and they ended up hiring me full time. And I became the, it was really the tech correspondent, but they called it the computer reporter on ABC News. And so a couple times a week, I'd show up on Good Morning America and explain to Joan London and the rest of America, how do you get online? You know, like, all the various computer things that Leo and I covered on the radio forever. You know, how do you know you're getting a good computer? Should I get a laptop or a PC? What's that noise my modem's making? You know, all that stuff. And then I also did news, like World News Tonight with Peter Jennings and Nightline, and I covered anything having to do with technology.
Did you get the feeling that you were way out on the edge and that people were having a hard time catching up and coping, or did you have a sense of satisfaction that you were really getting people educated and moving?
Well, I mean, we knew, or I knew that lots of people were starting to get interested in computers. I mean, the Windows 95 thing proved that. There were people waiting in line like it was a Rolling Stones concert. You know, it was very strange.
Because it was like a Mac. It was the first Windows computer that really looked like a Mac. I was in Oak Ridge at the time, and it was there was a lot of excitement about it because the idea was that, unfortunately, because of the lawsuit that Apple lost, Microsoft had a license to do overlapping Windows and make their Windows 95 look a lot like a Mac. And then that made a lot of people happy.
Yeah, a lot like a Mac, but still not as good, you know, not as streamlined. I mean, to this day, I finally switched to a Mac about 4 years ago. And like a lot of people, I was, you know, saying, "Oh no, I know Windows up and down. I know DOS. Why would I switch to this?" And the minute I switched to it, the difference was amazing to me. I mean, suddenly it was easy to set up a network. You know, suddenly I didn't have viruses and spyware all the time. Device drivers, yeah, I was an expert on. I never had to think about that again.
Wow. I want to ask you a jackpot question about ABC News. I'm burning to ask you this.
Sure.
Live television and television news can be rewarding and a lot of jazz and excitement, but what was the worst part about it? Was there something that really annoyed you?
What was the worst part of television?
Yeah.
Wow. Everything is the worst part of television. For
the hours, the being Johnny on the spot, the pressure, makeup.
TV, I mean, people care more about how you look, you know, than your story. And I had a source who was a CEO in Silicon Valley who called me the night before the government filed suit against Microsoft for monopolism. Mm-hmm. And I ran down to Peter Jennings' people, like they had the producer and stuff every night, like around this table, planning that night's show. I'm like, I've got this big story. And they're like, what? Tomorrow, the U.S. is going to file charges against Microsoft. And they just looked at me like, well, if that were true, wouldn't the New York Times have had that today? I mean, that, I was like, what? I mean, that a lot of TV, most of TV is at the time anyway, and probably now too, is getting its stories from print. And then they just use the medium of television to add pictures or maybe more commentators and stuff. But
that was one of the questions on my list is exactly that. How well do the news shows do delivering technical information? I know when I watch my local NBC station, nightly news, and after an Apple keynote or an Apple event, I go, well, they got that wrong. because they don't understand, they don't have the context and the background to understand the implications. They just skim off the surface and deliver what they think they know sometimes. And sometimes it's not right.
Well, I mean, that's why the TV networks really need a beat reporter. And back then they didn't have a beat reporter on TV. So you could announce anything. And if you could, you know, get that press or, you know, that announcement over to ABC, somebody would have covered it without really understanding it. And that was the whole reason I thought there was a need for it. Because it isn't just, you know, oh, this cool game is out or this cool product is out. It costs this and that. I mean, there were issues already starting that were important, you know, regarding privacy.
I've got a little sticker on my display that says community and context.
Yes, it really is context and being able to explain it. You know, that was the thing that nobody got in the early days, is that covering technology was really about interpreting it, you know, translating it. Yep. And, you know, ABC get a press release, say, from Microsoft or somebody, and they couldn't read past the first sentence. You know, what's an MB? You know,
don't get me started about distortion of the technology, about talking about the wrong units of measure and their improper capitalization and not separating the units from the numbers. Don't get me started.
They would see that stuff and think, oh, this isn't a story that our viewers would want. But Leo and I had been doing this radio show, and it had gotten huge. It was like in 80 cities and a million listeners. And that was back in 92, 93.
Tell you what, let's talk about Leo and all that in a minute. Right now, it's time for a break. Folks, we're going to have to take a quick break here. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm chatting with tech journalist Gina Smith. We will be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're chatting with Dr. Gina Smith, tech journalist. So tell me how you fell in with Leo and how that all got started.
Well, remember when I told you that John Dvorak was my mentor, and he really was. I met him literally the day I got to PC Week and we were at Comdex. And he at the time was a co-host with Leo Laporte on the show. And it was called On Computers, this radio show. And Leo in those days wasn't super technical like he is now. And so John was there to kind of, you know, do the meteor stuff. And that show was 3 hours live every Sunday. It was all call-in. So people would ask questions and you needed someone technical. Anyway, I got a call from him once. Can you fill in for me? And I was like, ooh, I don't know. I've never done radio. I filled in for him once and loved it. And John said, great, you do it. And then Leo and I co-hosted it for years and years on computers.
Tell me a little bit about John. This wasn't something I planned to ask you about, but, you know, John has had a reputation for writing some inflammatory articles in the past, and a lot of people in the Apple community have a sort of a mild distaste in their mouth. I referenced an article John Dvorak wrote last week, and my readers all of a sudden started, you know, getting on me about, you know, you shouldn't be quoting John Dvorak. And I'm going, oh, I respect everybody, and I've been reading John for years. What's he like in person?
He's not as crusty as you think. I mean, that whole crusty thing, maybe I shouldn't reveal this, but it's, you know,
sure.
It's just like his gig for that personality for his column. That's the column he writes. He's not a news reporter. He's a columnist. And, you know, you got to have a voice and stuff. And his is the crusty critic. Right. And that's what it is. He's got to be like, what? What do you mean? That's garbage.
I remember reading him on the back page of PC. InfoWorld.
InfoWorld
back when he was writing with Bob Cringely, and when it was the real Bob Cringely. Bob and I are fairly well acquainted with each other. And those are two guys started cranking me up about writing.
And when you say the real Bob Cringely, do you mean Mark Stevens?
Yeah, because what happened was, for a while he was writing for InfoWorld in the flesh. I have a mug, and then there was some lawsuit between them, and then Bob decided to go his separate way. And then I think InfoWorld ended up with a column under his name because of a legal agreement. But Mark wasn't really writing the column anymore.
Oh, but you know, I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that. Did he change his name legally to Bob? Because you just refer to him as Bob, and I always call him Mark when I ever see him.
Well, he still has a website where he's called I Cringely.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting story. You have to kind of really know about his career to figure out what's going on. Anybody who digs into his past finds out right away, you know, that he's Mark Stevens. But he doesn't really go by that name.
You know, I mean, Dvorak, Cringely, these are the whole reason I got into technology. Yeah. You know, I would read these computer columns and be long before I was at PC Week, and the only page I could understand was Dvorak's column or Mark's, you know, Cringely column, because they were written in plain English. And that was what I wanted to do. That was the whole reason I applied to PC Week, saying, you know, your stuff reads like it was written by, you know, somebody writing documentation, and it needs to be clean and English and breezy, you know. And they really set that up, them and Jerry Purnell, of course.
Oh yeah, I'm a big fan.
He's the first ever, you know, really computer columnist. Yeah, it's sad he died, you know, a few months ago.
Oh, Jerry did?
Yeah,
I didn't know that. I'm plugged into some sci-fi circles. I thought I would have heard about that on Twitter. Oh my!
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send you the list. Yeah, it was a real loss. And in fact, he's a co-owner of the site I do now. And so we were very sad, you know, just dealing with his family and stuff. He had done some wonderful work, and what a great writer he was, too.
Yes.
But, you know, they were writing about tech and doing it in plain English. And very few writers were, at the time, were doing more than just repeating press releases, you know, and that's what I wanted to do in technology. And again, like with Leo, it became very apparent that there really was a huge move for regular people all over the country to start getting computers. But yet you couldn't tell that from watching TV.
So you were plugged into the media pretty well, and that opened some doors for you. And you told me that you had bumped into Larry Ellison. And then there's a fascinating story you wanted to tell me about Gil Amelo and Steve Jobs. Tell me that.
Wow, jumping around. I've been a journalist pretty much without cease. They call that a career journalist, except for two ill-advised years during the dot-com time. And during that time, I was the president of the very first company that was an internet appliance. It was called Nick, and Larry and I ran that together. And so I got to run in all those circles during that time. And we were at Heidi Roizen's party in her backyard. And Gil Amelio was the president of Apple at that point. And he was in the backyard. And at the time, gosh, Apple stock was not quite a dollar. But I mean, Apple's fortunes were so bad that whenever anybody used the word Apple on the radio show, we used to play taps. Like there we had
was the black cover on Business Week too. I remember that.
Oh yeah, I mean it was surely going away. I mean, yeah. You know, it was just that they had a bunch of cash in the bank, they could delay it. And you know, it was tragic. Larry and Steve Jobs were best friends, and it was awful for them to watch it being destroyed. So we were at this party, and Gil Amelia was in the back, and I just ran up to him and said, "Hey, what are you going to do to turn Apple around?" And he's like, "Well, you know, Gina, Apple's like the boat." It is. Yeah, the boat's got a hole in it. And, you know, and the boat's on fire. You know, and my job is to make sure everybody's rowing in the right direction. And I was like, "But what about the hole? What about the fire?" And Larry was like literally on the ground laughing. And we later told that story to Steve Jobs. Larry had some kind of a barbecue at his house. And Steve Jobs had then repeated that story over and over again. It made it into Steve Jobs's book by Isaacson, but they got the story a little bit wrong. That's all right. It's my brush with fame is that story. So
I've got a video clip of that now. Thanks to you. I will put it in the show notes so that the listeners can enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, but the main thrust of it was Larry thought that Gil Amelio, to use his term, was kind of idiotic. They didn't think much of Gil Amelio and his ability to run Apple. And so this kind of proved to them that was true. And, you know, we'd sit around and talk about it all the time. Wouldn't it be cool if Steve could come back, you know, full time? He'd be on the cover of Time if he did. And then it really happened.
I remember the iCEO years. It was great.
Yeah.
What a change. Now the company is earning 220 or 240 billion a year in revenues and 250 billion in the bank. Wow. Yeah, that's a whole nother show.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that no matter how poor a business is going, if there's a ton of people out there, like there were this hardcore Apple fans, even when Apple was down to almost no one. You know, whenever you've got that, there's a chance to reignite it because you can't fake that.
So we don't have too much time left, but I want to make sure we carve out some time here to talk about how you got to know Steve Wozniak, and you are his biographer.
That book came out in 2006, I want to say, and then it came out again last year.
How did you get connected to Steve? Did he approach you because he had seen you on the news, or did you approach him?
You know, I had met everybody just as by virtue of a tech reporter before everybody was doing it. But Steve Wozniak left computers 4 years or 5 years before I was in computers. So I'd never met him. And a friend of mine who didn't know anything about computers was at, I can't think of the big concert place now in San Francisco. Anyway, she was at a concert and she texted me and said, "I just met a guy who claims he founded Apple. Ever heard of Steve Wozniak?" Mm. And I was like, "Oh, Michelle, oh my gosh, like, you know, get his number." And she did. And the next day I called him and said, "You've never done a book." And he said, no, I've started a bunch, but just never went anywhere or had to return the advance because I got so busy and I don't know. And I just, you know, you need a book like Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, speaking about astrophysics.
Oh, now you're my hero. Now I'm over at the top because as a physicist, Richard Feynman was my hero.
Yeah, I mean, he is the pinnacle of it.
I couldn't have gotten through graduate school without his red book, his three red books on physics. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Funny you should bring that up. A bolt from the blue, Gina.
We should talk sometime about Feynman and all. I've been wanting to do a book on this.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I never met him. He was already gone, but I read those books. They were kind of about jokes and pranks. And I knew Steve Wozniak's reputation. And I said, "Why don't you have a book like this?" And well, like you, the minute I said, you know, his name, Steve was like, "Okay, let's talk." And we had a book contracted within 3 days. We had one with them.
Now, did you have to sit with him for a long time? Because he probably didn't keep a diary or historical records and notes, or did he?
No, he didn't keep any notes. And also, if anyone knows Steve, I mean, he's brilliant, but he's also all over the place.
So you probably had to spend hours and hours doing interviews with him and recording and transcribing.
And trying to make time with him. I met him 3 times a week for 1.5 years anywhere. Oh, wow. He was eating. Because I'd say, well, you got to eat. So he went to this barbecue place all the time in Los Gatos. And I would just show up there and just turn on the tape recorder if it was 4 hours. And then later, when I was all done with him, I had all the tapes transcribed and stuff and try to make sense of it. I let him talk about whatever he wanted to. You know, it's because if you walk to Steve and say, hey, Steve, tell me about what happened in 1976, it would make him think of something that happened last week or something that happened 5 years ago. So I just had to let the tape run.
So I'm having fun interviewing you.
Well, they're all in my garage, like probably, I don't know, 4 feet tall of, like, you know, printed out transcripts and tapes. I've always wondered what to do with those things. Like, should I print them somewhere now that everybody can self-publish? Should I load those tapes up? I don't know.
I don't know. But that book became a New York Times bestseller, right?
Yeah, but you know what a lot of people don't realize is very few people remembered Steve Wozniak back then. I mean, even in Silicon Valley, I'd be interviewing him and he'd get up and go to the bathroom and people would walk over and say, who is that? Who is
really?
That person?
Really? Well, he kind of dropped off the planet for a while. He kind of does that for a while.
Yeah, and by then, Steve Jobs was the big hero, and most people really thought Steve Jobs was the one that, like, invented, you know, the Apple II or whatever. And if you ask Steve Wozniak, he'd go, no, no, Steve Jobs just carried the televisions, you know, to the homebrew club. he was in high school, you know. It really was Steve Wozniak, and this story wasn't told. And I don't think it was until he got on Dancing with the Stars, though, that mainstream America started realizing who he was. And that was to promote our book, that he went on Dancing with the Stars that summer.
Does a New York Times bestseller confer a certain amount of financial independence? Or is the book industry still kind of parsimonious in that respect?
Oh, the book industry is worse now than it was. I mean, I don't know. I've written 6 books, and the whole way the system is set up is so that the writer doesn't ever get paid more than the advance. They figure it all out. Like, this is how many sales we need to break even.
Oh, that's nice to know.
it's really sad. They're not really expecting these big hits. And even Norton, I mean, they weren't really, really pushing the Wozniak thing. I was the one that booked him on Dancing with the Stars because the host of that was somebody I'd worked with on a television project once. I mean, I pushed him on all that. So, yeah, am I rich and famous? A little famous in the Wozniak circle. But I get a check every couple of months for $200.
Wow. Yeah. So all you people who are out there thinking about writing a novel or a technical book, you know, be thoughtful about how you spend your time and how much money it's going to make you, because there might be other avenues.
Yeah, novels may be different, you know.
No, novels are not much different. Yeah. Andy Weir had to go to Amazon first and sell The Martian on Amazon before the big publishers realized there was a hit.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you don't do a book because you want to be famous. You do a book out of love.
Passion.
And if it does really well, then it does. And I wanted to be the person who said to, hey, everybody, this is the guy that invented the computer, literally invented the desktop computer. And we explain why it's him in the book. But I wanted people to know who he was and not think Steve Jobs had done it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, we're about out of time. We just have a couple more minutes left. I wanted to ask you about your latest project, A New Domain. Not really that recent. A New Domain? What are you working on there with that?
Okay, the site is called anewdomain.net or .com. And I was the editor of Byte, the Byte's relaunch back in 2011. And the publishing company had closed that up too early, right after we launched. And we had 60 writers with nothing to do. And I left and I was sad, and a bunch of the writers called and said, no, no, we have to do our own Byte. And I'm like, with what money? You know, and we just started the site where everybody was writing. And to this day, it's a fairly big site.
Did you need seed money to get that going? Or
No seed money. We bought the name for like $9. And what we do is we're totally not ad supported or anything. But what we are is a clearinghouse for any journalist who can't get their article published because it's too long, too niche-y, too controversial, too upsetting to an advertiser. They can come to us and we'll run it.
I might end up working for you some days.
I'd love it. We should run your podcast on the site, you know, because we invite up.
Feel free. I'll be sending you a link to the podcast and the article. So, yeah, we want to promote it as much as we can.
Yeah, we were the ones who broke the story that Ashley Madison wasn't really hacked and it wasn't really a dating site. And the BBC did a whole documentary around our reporting there.
Interesting. Yeah. I wish we had more time to go into it, but we don't. Now we are out of time.
Thanks for having me.
What a nice story. And this was inspiring and fun. Thanks.
I'm so grateful. I can't wait to call you after this and find out all about your time working for working in astrophysics. Wow.
Yeah, that helped me a lot in my career because it got me familiar with the fundamentals. And then I did R&D at Lockheed Martin. I got my hands dirty with, aerospace stuff. So that was a good background for computers, too. Yeah. Well, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish. What's your preferred method?
Well, I mean, they can direct message me on Twitter. I have it open for all DMs. So I'm at Gina Smith 888, G-I-N-A, Smith 888. They can come to A New Domain and I'm Gina at anewdomain.net, okay. G-I-N-A at anewdomain.net. And yeah, just link with me. I'm pretty open. I talk to everybody. So,
okay, listeners, here's your opportunity. You might get a lead. You might make a contact of a lifetime. So,
especially if they want to write, they should send me because we're always looking for great content.
Gina, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a delightful show. A pleasure to get to know you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, John. We'll be in touch.
Okay, great. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Gina Smith, the tech journalist. And we will see you again next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.